The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Two huge U.S. Supreme Court rulings last month grabbed the nation's attention for weeks. The decision upholding the Affordable Care Act and the affirmation of same-sex marriage. But with those cases generating so much debate, other rulings slid under the radar, and several were significant and controversial, with the justices in each split 5-4. This hour, we dig into three that legal experts say stand out. One has to do with air pollution from power plants and EPA regulations. Another concerns racial discrimination in housing. And a third is about the practice of gerrymandering, the drawing of political districts in a way that favors one party over the other. Today in The Exchange, what you need to know about those lesser-known rulings. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We're joined for the hour by John Grabe. He's a constitutional law professor at UNH. John, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And I also want to add that in the summer, you are also a professor at the Advanced Studies Program at St. Paul's School, and one of your classes is here today, so welcome to them as well.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Also, as we switch topics, we're going to hear from people involved in those particular subjects. And as we turn to the redistricting case first, Dante Scala is on the line to help us out. Dante is an associate professor of political science at UNH, a fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy. Dante, welcome.
Good morning.
Well, let's talk about gerrymandering, Dante. And I gave a little description, but how do you define gerrymandering?
Yeah, I mean, gerrymandering is basically the manipulation of the lines that make up legislative districts. And this could be at the state legislative level or at the level of Congress and the House of Representatives. So as we know, like, we have single-member districts, so people are elected from particular territories. So the first congressional district, for example, takes up the eastern half of the state. So redistricting takes place usually every 10 years after a census is taken, and we count the government counts everybody. We might reallocate seats among the various states because of population shifts, and then within each state decides how to redraw the lines. And within a few boundary rules, such as, you want the districts to be as equal in population as possible, traditionally political parties have had, and usually the majority party, has had the ability to redraw the lines in order to maximize their benefit. So if you have a Democrat and you have a Republicans in charge as the majority party in the state, they might redraw the Democrats' district to move out some Republicans, draw them out, or draw in Republicans in order to make the district more competitive or even tilting the other way.
How big a problem, Dante, do most Americans think gerrymandering is?
Well, I think the conventional wisdom now, at least among, the political media and so forth, is that gerrymandering is a leading culprit in why our politics are so polarized. And it works something like this. One, legislators get to draw up their own districts. By doing so, they make their districts safer by limiting the number of voters from the other party. So they make districts more partisan, less competitive. If districts are less competitive, then the representatives who represent those districts have less incentive to appeal to the voters of the other party. And therefore, there's lots of incentive to be polarized and less incentive to be cooperative. And so people look at these independent commissions, such as the one in Arizona, as a way to reduce the polarization by creating more competitive districts in which representatives will feel compelled to reach across the aisle to voters of the other party.
So gerrymandering, often blamed for the hardening lines of American political life. And John Grabe, let's talk about the case at hand a little bit. How did the people in Arizona, this is the case that had to do with gerrymandering, try to stop it?
Well, in 2000, Arizona voters approved a ballot initiative which would have shifted, which did shift power away from the state legislature to draw district lines and created a nonpartisan independent commission that would engage
good,
in that
right?
redistricting. That's right. And the idea is to, you know, to ameliorate this the partisan effects that Dante was just talking about. Now, the problem with this, at least according to the Arizona State Legislature, was that this ballot initiative and this shift of power, in fact, violated the federal constitution, because Article 1 of the federal constitution, in particular the Elections Clause, says that congressional districts voting for Congress, for the federal Congress, congressional districts are to be drawn up by the legislature of the state. And this commission is not the legislature. So the Arizona legislature brought a lawsuit that went to the Supreme Court, and last week it was decided that, in fact, it was okay. It was consistent with the United States Constitution for Arizona voters to adopt this commission. That was a 5-4 decision over some very strong dissenting opinions by the more conservative members of the court.
So why did the majority decide, though, that it was okay? I mean, the Constitution says it's to be done by the legislature, so how did the majority wiggle around that?
Well, they had a bunch of arrows in their quiver, but the principal one was a dictionary definition, an understanding that the term legislature at the time Article 1 was ratified could include the people themselves acting through measures such as ballot initiatives, and that it didn't necessarily restrict itself to the state legislature. And so Justice Ginsburg, writing for a majority, pointed to that and said that the Constitution, the federal Constitution, and its use of that term legislature in Article 1 did not mean to foreclose actions by the people in this way.
Again, the number here in the exchange for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're taking a look at three recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions with possible big implications that have not gotten as much attention as the same-sex marriage decision and the Affordable Care Act decision. Let's hear from you. At this point in the hour, we're talking about a decision on redistricting. Later on, we'll talk about a housing discrimination case and then a case concerning air pollution and EPA regulations. Again, you can join us with your comments and questions, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. So, Dante, how many other states besides Arizona have done something similar with this sort of independent, nonpartisan commission?
Yeah, about half a dozen with regard to drawing congressional lines and several more than that, kind of talking about state legislatures as well.
Is this a popular movement, Dante? I mean, do you expect more people to move to this now that Arizona has, gotten affirmation by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah, I think there'll be a boost. I suspect that we'll see that in upcoming years, that they're, you know, perhaps by 2020 when or 2022 when we're doing this all over again after the next census, that there might have been referenda in which some additional states look to this and follow Arizona's lead.
What are the national implications then, Dante? What do you think? Are we going to see a reduction down the line of, well, a softening of the harder political lines that you talked about?
The evidence
is this
so
the cure?
The evidence so far suggests that this isn't going to be the kind of the silver bullet that ends polarization. You know, political scientists have found that the effects of these independent commissions are modest. And really, that leads to a broader thing, issue, that redistricting itself has a modest effect on, or how you draw the lines has a modest effect on polarization compared to other big factors going on politically in the country. For instance, people themselves are sorting themselves out. In fact, one author described it as the big sort, that we see increasing evidence that Republicans tend to live next to other Republicans, and Democrats tend to live geographically next to other Democrats. Like, for example, we tend to find Democrats concentrated in urban areas. So that's not a redistricting thing. That's just how people are sorting themselves out. And it would be difficult to redistrict around that. Another factor is incumbency and campaign finance. The fact that incumbents have a big advantage, including being able to raise campaign funds, is a big factor in keeping districts non-competitive, bigger perhaps than how you draw the lines.
Well, Dante, if this did have an impact on New Hampshire in terms of changing the way lines are drawn, sounds like our first and second congressional district wouldn't change that much. I mean, those districts are pretty much set. Are there possible implications for redrawing of lines in New Hampshire?
Possibly. I mean, I guess theoretically it's possible if the state legislature, for instance, might decide to delegate redistricting to a commission. There hasn't been any move for that lately. It raises another issue, though, that sometimes, redistricting is not just about incumbent protection. Like, look at what Republicans did in the state Senate after 2010. They tried to redraw the lines to make more districts competitive in order to increase the number of seats they controlled in the state Senate. And in that, by doing that, they actually introduced more moderate legislators, one might argue. Say, Nancy Stiles' seat, very moderate Republican out on the seacoast. By drawing the lines a certain way, they made it possible for a moderate Republican like her to compete. So a lot depends on whether one party's in control or whether it's a divided legislature, how the lines are redrawn.
Okay. Dante Scala, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
That's Dante Scala, associate professor at UNH, a fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy. His new co-authored book is called The Four Faces of the Republican Party, The Fight for the 2016 Presidential Nomination. It's due out later this year. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. John Grabe, one more question for you on this redistricting case before we move to some of the other cases, including housing discrimination. Wasn't the redistricting case, John, one where one of the justices used the word chumps?
Yes. And it wasn't Justice Scalia, to the surprise of everyone.
What was that about?
It was an argument that led off the dissenting opinion by Chief Justice Roberts. And he was pointing to the fact that the 17th Amendment, which was ratified early in the 20th century, changed the way in which U.S. senators were chosen. Prior to the adoption of the 17th Amendment, state legislatures did it. After the 17th Amendment, that power was shifted to the people.
Direct elections.
What chumps they were to go through the whole process of amending the Constitution. They should have just come to this liberal permissive court and gotten permission to do it that way.
Okay.
That was the nature of the argument.
Well, probably the first time we've heard the word chump used at the U.S. Supreme Court. We will talk more after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, we're looking at three recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions overshadowed by the rulings on same-sex marriage and the Affordable Care Act. We turn now to a case concerning housing discrimination. UNH constitutional law professor John Grabe is with us for the hour, and in a moment, we'll hear from two people with a particular interest in this case. You can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, John, let's just set up this case a little bit. It's pretty specific, and yet a lot of people say this does have wide implications. So let's just unpack it. Who was upset about what in this housing discrimination case?
Okay. Well, there was a fair housing group called the Inclusive Communities Project that thought that the state of Texas housing agency was distributing tax credits, which are used to incentivize the building of low-income housing, that they were doing it in a way that was perpetuating racial discrimination in housing. And so they brought a lawsuit under a 1968 federal statute known as the Fair Housing Act asking for reform, asking for a remedy that would cause the state to reallocate these tax credits in a different way. And the question at the root of the case was whether they could win their lawsuit under this statute by proving something less than an intention to discriminate on the part of the state. And the court, in a very narrowly divided opinion, said yes, that a disparate impact, that when the state is adopting housing policies that have a disparate impact and that tend to perpetuate the segregation patterns in housing that led to the enactment of the Fair Housing Act in 1968, that can be enough to hold the state liable and to bring about such a remedy.
What does disparate impact mean?
That disparate impact means when the state is undertaking measures that fall more heavily on one racial or ethnic group than another. So if they're distributing tax credits in such a way that it's incentivizing people to live in racially identifiable areas rather than integrating, that can be evidence of a disparate impact of the underlying policy.
Those involved with this issue, I'm sure you've read this, John, say this ruling was a watershed moment for housing. What do you think? Why?
Well, I think the movement with respect to discrimination generally on this court has been towards saying that that the state should only be held to violate the law, and sometimes private individuals should only be held to violate the law when you can establish that they are intentionally discriminating on the basis of race, that it gets too messy, and that it leads to things like quotas, which nobody wants and everybody regards as unconstitutional, if we permit liability to be imposed absent a showing of an intent to discriminate against minority groups. I think a lot of people thought that so-called disparate impact liability might be dead after this case. And with Justice Kennedy joining with the more liberal justices, I think people who take that perspective take heart in the fact that this still is a tool that's available to try to bring about housing reform through litigation.
Well, and again, we have two people on the line with a particular interest in this housing discrimination case. Joining us now is Fred Mayer. He's a Nashua attorney who primarily represents landlords in the state. And Fred Mayer, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, just broadly first, please, your reaction to this ruling.
Disappointed. The thing I dislike about the ruling, even though it was not entirely unexpected, there's certainly precedent among the circuit court decisions for what the majority ruled, but how the Supreme Court majority went in this case. I was disappointed because I was hopeful that at least in the context of housing discrimination, we would have discrimination law where intent mattered. And my primary objection to the disparate impact theory or tactic of litigation is that enables someone to establish discrimination in the context of the case where the individual landlord or property owner doesn't actually have an intent to discriminate.
So it makes it too easy to sue, basically.
Exactly, because it now, if you have numbers that statistically demonstrate that you are affecting a particular protected class disproportionately, you're subject to challenge. Now you are forced to defend yourself initially to HUD or in this state to the Human Rights Commission during an investigation phase. And if there is a finding against you and a finding that there's reasonable cause to believe that you've discriminated, then you're at the HUD level, then you wind up in federal court. I think to give an example, if I have a landlord, I want to be able to screen tenants based on their creditworthiness and based on whether they have, for example, a history of violence. So my concern is, with all the publicity that disparate impact theory now has, maybe advocates on the side of the tenant will become more aggressive in using that theory, and perhaps they'll argue that given that that people with disabilities, including mental impairments, that's a protected class under the Fair Housing Act. So what if, when you screen for folks who've committed crimes of violence, you disproportionately impact those with mental disabilities? What if you screen for creditworthiness, you disproportionately affect those with disabilities? Does my client, my landlord, who say has a four unit or a duplex, or I'm sorry, duplex is a bad example, that falls into an exemption, a four unit building that's not owner occupied, does he now have to demonstrate that there's some other legitimate business reason for having those kinds of simple common sense standards for screening tenants?
So if you try to screen out someone who, for example, as you said, has a history of violence, some clever lawyer may find that they're a member of a protected class, as you say, and figure out a way to sue you, even though you're just trying to keep violent people out of your buildings.
Well, from my perspective, it's worse than that, because if you get to the point where you're actually in court and you're litigating one of these cases, I think you've already lost from the perspective of a landlord trying to run a successful business, because these discrimination statutes set up a mechanism whereby if somebody files a complaint with HUD, then HUD will start investigating. And during that pre-litigation phase, HUD has tremendous power. They can, if they want to, they can do subpoenas, they can take depositions, et cetera. And even if they choose not to do that, if my landlord client gets a letter from a HUD investigator that says, we want to see all your leases for the past 5 years, we want to see every application that's been submitted to you over the past 5 years, we want to see every ad you've placed over the past 5 years, I'm going to tell my client to comply with those requests, however burdensome or onerous they might think those requests are, because the individual who's making those requests is ultimately going to decide whether they believe there is reasonable cause to conclude that discrimination occurred. And if that investigator comes to that conclusion, then my client could wind up either litigating before a HUD administrative law judge where the tenant is represented by a HUD lawyer, or if he opts to go to federal court where the Department of Justice will come in and represent the tenant, and my client will be paying someone to defend him out of pocket. And I get back to the fact that this could all happen in the context of someone who had literally had no intention to discriminate, because under the disparate impact theory, the lack of any intention to discriminate does not matter.
So, and in a moment, Fred, we will have somebody on who's got another opinion who likes this ruling. But my last question for you is, given the big concerns that you've raised, why do you think a majority of justices went the other way?
That I can't tell you. I read Judge Alito's dissenting opinion. He focused on the word because of, so that in under his view of the world, you would only be finding discrimination if you could prove that somebody acted because of someone's membership in a protected class. The majority, other than the majority opinion being consistent with how circuit courts around the nation have viewed the issue, I have no explanation for it.
Okay. Well, Fred Mayer, good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Fred Mayer, a Nashua attorney who primarily represents landlords. You can join us, too, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And joining us now is Elliot Berry. He's an attorney with the New Hampshire Legal Assistance, which provides civil legal services to low-income residents. And Elliot Berry, thank you also for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, we just
hello, Fred.
Well, Fred is not with us now, but we just did hear from Fred, very disappointed and sounds a little nervous about the implications of this ruling for landlords. How do you feel about the Supreme Court decision?
Well, obviously, I'm really pleased. And one thing that's really important to remind Fred to make him feel a little better, and maybe other landlords or government officials out there, is the decision doesn't change a thing. As Fred noted, every single court of appeals in the United States who faced this question, and that's 11 out of 12, affirmed the theory of disparate impact. So it's been out there for decades, and advocates for who are trying to end housing discrimination have been successfully using it for years. So it's no sea change. It's a wonderful decision in that it is a ringing endorsement of the really important role that the theory of disparate impact has had in removing barriers to fair housing.
So what about New Hampshire, Elliot? What impact might we see here?
Well, again, we have for years represented clients who are facing problems that are useful. We've been representing clients using the disparate impact theory to help people who are subject to policies that injure them because of their membership in a protected class. An example of that, one that comes up very often, is occupancy standards, where people say a landlord will say no more than two people can live in a given unit. Now, it may very well be that there's no reason in the world that that three or four people can't live there, except the landlord doesn't want to have children. Now, discrimination against families with children is illegal both under federal and under state law, and as the court decision recognizes, however, disparate impact is often the only way you can get at that discrimination because people don't want to say, they know it's illegal, and they don't want to say, we don't want to have any kids. And one of the things that's really important to remember, though, about this decision is that it is crystal clear that you can't use it based on statistics alone. You have to show that there is a causal connection between the disparate impact, which has been established by statistics, and the actual practice or policy that's being challenged.
Is this then, it sounds like from what you're saying, it's not just about racial discrimination. This could encompass all sorts of other groups.
That's absolutely true. And because of the demographic makeup of the state of New Hampshire, most of the cases in which we utilize the theory involve things like disability or family status discrimination, not race.
How did you heard, again, the concerns from Fred Mayer? You know, he sounded like he was worried that landlords would face a heavy burden, that the housing department at the federal level would come in and say, look, we've gotten a complaint, we're investigating you. And even if it ended up okay in the end, that landlord could spend, you know, a lot of time and effort pulling together documents and so forth.
Again, there's no change. That's been going on for decades, and I don't see a lot of abuse. Secondly, that's all of the things that he worried about can happen in a claim of intentional discrimination. I mean, there's no, whether it's an administrative proceeding or the courts, people get to make complaints, and even people whose claims are rather questionable. And so, again, I go back to the theme here that there isn't a big change. It's simply a continuation of the status quo. And, litigation is expensive, and it's great for people and time-consuming. And it's wonderful when you can avoid it. But when you're talking about the importance of equal housing opportunity, it's necessary for people to have the necessary tools to combat that. And again, I stress that so often,
right,
so often the discriminatory actions are hidden, and disparate impact, as the court recognized, is the only way to get at that.
Elliot Berry, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
That's Elliot Berry, an attorney with New Hampshire Legal Assistance. Again, you can join us as we look at three lesser-known court decisions that came down recently, 1-800-892-6477. Right now, we're focusing on one that has to do with housing discrimination. A little bit later, we'll look at another one that has to do with EPA regulation of air pollution from power plants. John Graby, real quick point to you. First, we heard Fred Mayer say this is a big change. It's going to make it easier to sue. Then we heard Elliot Berry saying this is just a continuation of current policy. Does this ruling really change things or not?
No. I mean, I think it's true that precedent has suggested that disparate impact is a theory available under the Fair Housing Act and under other federal anti-discrimination statutes as well. It's just that given the direction of the Roberts Court, I think a lot of people thought – that it was on its deathbed, and its survival has come as a surprise. But no, I think it's correct to say that it doesn't change circumstances all that much.
Here's an email from Tyler who says, how do you think this court's ruling on discrimination in housing will affect its current stance on affirmative action? So again, this idea of, you know, protected groups and how they're regarded and treated. Thank you, Tyler, for the email.
Well, there are a couple of steps in between. Affirmative action is being played out, and the permissibility of affirmative action is an issue that's arising under the Constitution, whereas this was simply a case about interpreting a federal statute. Now, it's true, the Constitution was lurking in the background, and there's no doubt that the more conservative members of the Supreme Court are concerned about imposing liability in circumstances for discrimination theories where the actor doesn't have a discriminatory effect. I don't think that this says a whole lot other than that Justice Kennedy may not be as eager for change in the area of discrimination as many conservatives might have hoped that he is. And, you know, if he stays where he is, affirmative action may yet survive. It's the challenge that's already on the docket for next year.
Well, and maybe later on we'll talk about some of the other cases that might be coming up next year. Here's another email. This is from Luke. Justice Scalia has been receiving widespread criticism for his strict interpretation of the Constitution in recent landmark cases. Luke says, do you believe this type of constitutional interpretation is inhibiting progress, or is it promoting a democratic process? Big question.
It is a big question. You know, I don't think you can give a one-size-fits-all answer to that. I think that a strict construction of the Constitution sometimes is rights-preserving in ways where perhaps Democratic majorities see the right in question as not such a great right. Think about gun control, for example. Rights go both ways. Some would define progress there as an ability of Democratic majorities to chip away at rights. Obviously, that same group might define progress very, very differently in the context of the liberty to marry somebody with the same sexual orientation. So it's a big question. It's a fascinating question. It's a really fun one to think about in all sorts of different contexts.
Well, and how do you define progress? That's
right.
Very
exactly.
Personal. Okay, thank exactly. You for that email. I've got a couple more to share with you. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Coming up, we'll look at another ruling on power plant emissions. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're examining several less familiar U.S. Supreme Court rulings that were just released. For the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about one more case on the cost of clean air regulations. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guest for the hour is John Graby, constitutional law professor at UNH Law. And John, let's tackle the last of these three rulings that we're looking at, yet another 5-4 decision. This has to do with how the EPA regulates power plant emissions. What EPA rule was it questioned in this case?
Well, the EPA had adopted, has been going through a process under a federal statute known as the Clean Air Act, which is imposing more onerous requirements on facilities that emit air pollution. And the question in this case was whether or not EPA should have taken costs into account, should have done a cost-benefit analysis earlier in the process than they did in deciding whether to promulgate these regulations. It's like many cases that come before the court, it's very technical and you have to get in the weeds to understand the facts. But sort of sitting behind it is a strong ideological debate among the various blocks on the court about the extent to which courts ought to be deferring to the expertise of administrative agencies. And that in turn raises questions about separation of powers at the federal level.
Exactly. That's basic civics, right? You've got the legal, the judicial, and the executive. So how much should that judicial branch respect the way the executive branch is carrying out its understanding of rulemaking.
That's exactly right. And to what extent should the judiciary be stepping in to say, you know, when Congress passed this act and gave you power, executive branch, how much power did it delegate to you? And if Congress is perceived as delegating too much power to the executive branch, that in turn raises another separation of powers question. So there's like two dimensions to this. To what extent should judges respect decisions about how to interpret laws by executive bureaucrats? And to what extent should Congress be permitted to hand off its lawmaking power to the executive branch and agencies which are under control of the president?
Well, okay, another 5-4 ruling. All three that we're talking about this hour were 5-4. What did the majority say here in this EPA case?
Well, the majority, and it's an opinion written by Justice Scalia, said that EPA had not engaged in a reasonable interpretation of the Clean Air Act in declining to do a cost-benefit analysis right at the outset of its consideration of whether or not to adopt these regulations. There is no dispute that EPA did do cost-benefit analysis as the process went on, but it decided early on that it was going to take action and then said we're going to work out in the course of evaluating these things precisely how we're going to weigh costs versus the benefits of regulation. The dissent written by Justice Kagan says this is how human beings solve problems all the time. At the outset, you often don't have enough information to conduct a cost-benefit analysis. And the dissent here doesn't say that EPA should not be conducting a cost-benefit analysis. They would just give EPA the breathing room to decide for itself at what point in the process.
So at some level, it's a timing decision, very picky, but at some level, it's huge.
That's right.
Who gets to decide what?
That's right. And if and I think it would be fair to say that the majority is skeptical of regulation. And by imposing an obligation that an agency do this sort of analysis right at the outset, it makes it more complicated, more difficult for the agency to regulate.
Well, throughout the hour, as we talk with John Grabe about some of these Supreme Court decisions, we've also been bringing in interested voices. And with us now is Dan Simmons, Vice President of Policy for the Institute for Energy Research. And Dan Simmons, good to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, how do you feel about this decision?
I was surprised with this decision, and I am rather pleased with it. We will see what happens in the end, because it's just one decision, and it seems to be a bit of a break from prior cases, that this one issue hasn't necessarily been looked at. There is a part of the Clean Air Act that actually forbids EPA from considering costs. That is a part of the Clean Air Act called the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. This part of the Clean Air Act doesn't contain such a prohibition. So it makes sense that EPA hasn't necessarily considered costs at the outset, because of much of what they do deals with these National Ambient Air Quality Standards. So in moving to other parts of the act, it is interesting that they at the outset should not only consider the cost, but also the benefits. And in this case, it is particularly kind of interesting, because the cost of this regulation are about $9.6 billion a year, $9.6 billion with a B. And the benefits of these mercury reductions, because this is a regulation of mercury, everyone knows that mercury is definitely harmful at high doses, but the benefits of those reductions in mercury are, according to EPA's analysis, are between 4 and 6 million. So we're talking about costs in the billions, benefits in the millions. So it's a large differential.
What do you think is important for people to understand about this, Dan? And you've touched on it some, but again, from the point of view of power plants, utilities, energy generators, what do you want the average person to understand about this?
The first thing is that costs matter, that it isn't just this isn't just an issue of that there are, that we can only look at the benefits. In everything that we do in our lives, we try to consider costs, costs, both the cost of doing something and also the benefits that we get out of doing something. And it's easy to think that imposing costs on utilities, costs on power plants, that it is kind of a free ride for the rest of us. However, many, in fact, probably much of the United States is we buy our electricity from regulated utilities. And what that really means is that utilities are guaranteed a rate of return on their investments. And so if the Public Utility Commission okays new investments, as they will do to comply with this case and already have around the country, what that means is that each and every one of us pays higher electricity bills. It isn't just that we can always soak the utilities to get these environmental benefits, but that all of us in the end pay for them. So I think it is critical that we look at the costs and both the costs and benefits, and hopefully upfront in deciding whether to regulate.
Well, and EPA, as you know, said it felt the public health costs outweighed the financial costs that the industry would have to bear to be in compliance. So how should we, as just regular folks, sort that out?
That, to me, there is it is very difficult to disentangle public health costs and public health benefits, in that when we, all of us, when we, are considering our spending, one of the things that we spend money on is obviously taking care of our health and welfare. When we have less, less income because we have higher electricity bills, for example, that means that we have less money to do things that will improve our health. And in fact, there was a survey that was done by the people that administer the LIHEAP program, that is the Low Income Energy Assistance Program. And what they found is that when lower and middle income families, when they experience higher energy prices, that a third of them, I mean, this specifically dealt with low income families, but when they had to deal with paying more for energy, nearly a third of people went without food for a day. 42% went without medical care or dental care, and the list goes on in the sorts of decisions that lower income people have to make when dealing with higher energy prices. But by having higher energy prices, that means that we have to make decisions. So while we talk about benefits, while we talk about the benefits, we also need to consider the cost, because both benefits and cost go to, what affects our health.
So you're saying there's a public health cost to poverty as well, and increased poverty due to high energy costs?
Thank you. That is a very good way of putting it.
Well, and one last question for you, Dan. Again, we appreciate your time. And in a moment, we'll have somebody who is on the other side of this case. Here in New England, there has been concern about air pollution from other states. We, in general, have felt like our power plants have done a pretty good job cleaning up. People in New England, governors from both parties, talk about New England as the tailpipe in the Midwest. So there's this impression that, those power plants out there are sending, because of the way the winds work, sending their pollution in here. What's your message for New Englanders in particular, in who have a concern about, pollution being blown in from elsewhere?
Well, the first thing is that there is a great story to be told about air quality in the United States, or air quality everywhere in the United States, whether it is in and including New England, and that is that air quality is far better than it's been in the past. It's increased in the past 10 years alone, which is kind of surprising to me. But also, total air pollution emissions since 1970 are down 68%. So that's not just the level of pollution in the air, that is total emissions, even as the economy has grown and we drive more miles because the population has grown. Total pollution emissions are down 68%. And so, there are still pollution concerns, and those are things that we should definitely look at and figure out ways to continue to reduce pollution. But the real success story is that our air has gotten cleaner, and with the measures that are currently in place, we'll actually continue to get cleaner. And that is that's a great success story.
Okay. Dan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dan Simmons, Vice President of Policy for the Institute for Energy Research. With us now is Tom Irwin, Vice President and Director at the Conservation Law Foundation in New Hampshire. And Tom Irwin, how are environmental groups in the Granite State reacting to this Supreme Court ruling on EPA air quality?
Well, we think this is a very unfortunate decision. We know that power plants across the country are a very significant source of pollution, with very significant public health impacts. And, you know, as John described, the Supreme Court reached its decision on a very technical basis. They went back to the very first step in the regulatory process where EPA determined that it was appropriate and necessary, given the health impacts of coal-fired and oil-fired power plants, to regulate the emissions from those facilities. And what the Supreme Court did was engage in a very intensive and narrow reading of the term appropriate, and determined that because EPA only looked at health impacts and did not look at costs at that very first kickoff of the regulatory process, the court determined that it didn't comply with the Clean Air Act. The Justice Kagan's dissent does a great job outlining the regulatory process that took place after the EPA made that kickoff decision that it is appropriate and necessary to regulate power plants. The dissenting opinion outlines, you know, basically a decade's worth of analysis of very complex issues and detailed analysis of the economic benefits of regulating power plants. And Dan is correct that in 2000, when EPA made its appropriate and necessary determination, when it determined that it would regulate, they had a very limited analysis of the economic benefits of regulating mercury at that time. But in the regulatory process that's followed, they have determined that this regulatory program will result in quantifiable benefits of up to $90 billion per year. That's billion with a B.
The benefits, the economic benefits of clean air.
Exactly. The economic benefits, $90 billion per year compared to that $10 billion per year cost.
What's
and to put this in more real terms,
yeah,
the EPA has determined that this regulatory program could prevent as many as 11,000 premature deaths per year and many more illnesses caused by respiratory problems.
Well, Tom, from what I've read, you know, this doesn't mean that all of a sudden the EPA can't regulate emissions. It just has to, you know, do a little more due diligence, so to speak. It doesn't mean these regulations are wiped off the books now.
That's correct. The good news here, and really, you know, one could say, and EPA may say so, that the due diligence has been done. So again, going back to the fact that this was really a technical or procedural technicality that the court ruled on, the good news is the court did not vacate the regulations. They've remanded it to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which will be determining how best to proceed at this point. EPA has done, as mentioned, this very extensive cost-benefit analysis, which could allow it to cure this technical defect very quickly. And I believe, as Dan mentioned, the ruling here is very limited. It only pertains to this one section of the Clean Air Act. It doesn't have implications on other programs within the Clean Air Act.
All right. Tom Irwin, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Tom Irwin, Vice President and Director of the Conservation Law Foundation in New Hampshire. And John Graby, just about a minute left. We've talked about, again, these three cases that were handed down this year. Which ones are you looking at for the court next year?
Well, the court already, as I mentioned before, has agreed to hear for a second time a case raising a challenge to the way in which the University of Texas takes race into account in conducting its admissions procedure. So, again, the future of so-called affirmative action is at least theoretically on the line.
Wow, we've been talking about that in court cases for a long time.
That's right. It was upheld by the barest of majorities in 2003, but in an opinion by Justice O'Connor suggesting that in 25 years, taking race into account for purposes of achieving the benefits of diversity that might not be permitted anymore. There are also abortion, public sector unions, whether public sector union members can be forced to pay dues to support collective bargaining under the First Amendment. That's also an issue. And finally, how we count voters for purposes of the one person, one vote principle, whether or not in drawing district lines, total population should be used or just simply the population of eligible voters. And if they say only eligible voters, that could really shift power away from urban areas where lots of aliens live and children and people who are not eligible voters. So a lot of big issues already on the court's docket for next year.
Okay. Plenty to talk about then. John Grabe, thank you so much for helping us out this morning.
Oh, sure. Thank you for having me.
That's John Grabe. He teaches constitutional law at UNH Law. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our intern is Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.